Chapter 2. Perkins School for the Blind. I want all people in town and all around here to know about deafblind people, that they can do things same as hearing people. Deafblind people can do many, many things, but sometimes it just takes a little bit longer, but they can do the same things other people can do, a quote from Eddie Martinez, Perkins student. His hand was still wet from his last swim. As I lightly held it and shifted my fingers in his palm, Eddie could understand my conversation with him and my father and stepmother Linda, who had come to watch the swim meet. Eddie was deaf and blind, and like Helen Keller, touch was his world. He lightly touched my palm in return, his fingers doing the talking. "Eddie is asking if you guys like to swim too," I said, smiling. "Yes," my father enthusiastically replied, amazed that Eddie and I were able to communicate with such small, personal touch. "As a matter of fact, I taught this lady right here how to swim when she was 6 years old." Eddie smiled as his fingers motioned a new idea. I laughed, explaining what Eddie had said. "Eddie wants to challenge me to a race." I shook my head, motioning back and speaking aloud that my father and Linda would understand. "You'd win the race, hands down." I have met and worked with many students over the course of my life, but from the day I met Eddie until years later when I ran into him at a CBEC deafblind retreat and discovered that he had earned a master's degree in counseling, he proved one of the truest embodiments of the Camp Abilities mantra, believe you can achieve. The photo description is Eddie riding a unicycle on a guide wire, Eddie riding a unicycle along a ladder in a gym, and then Eddie riding the unicycle along the track independently. Eddie was on the swim team I coached at Perkins. He also ran track and field, played goalball, the first international sport for the blind described later, and participated in community rowing on the nearby Charles River. Deafblind from rubella, his mother had had rubella during pregnancy, he could see light and dark contrasts as well as some shapes. Other than needing tactile signs to indicate the start of the race and to communicate feedback afterward, he was similar to his peer athletes who are blind or visually impaired. When he met my father and stepmother, Linda, Eddie was upbeat, gregarious, and curious. The interaction stayed with them forever. Eddie taught me a lot about communication, clarity, and inclusion. Early in my time at Perkins, when Eddie and I would encounter another person on our walks around campus, he would never fail to remind me if I forgot to sign what the other person had said. He needed everything from the environment interpreted and explained to him. When new construction appeared on campus, or when someone returned from maternity leave, no longer pregnant, or when a sign at the pool read closed, this all had to be conveyed to him. Through Eddie, I fully internalized that any incidental information that a person who is deafblind cannot gain from sight or hearing must be shared. Keeping my eye on the goal ball. Working at Perkins was a dream come true. Founded in 1829, the school had an international reputation for developing the potential of students with blindness, visual impairment, and deafblindness. Some children had additional disabilities such as cerebral palsy, seizures, autism, or intellectual disabilities. Perkins was equipped with an exceptional staff, which included orientation and mobility specialists, teachers of people who are visually impaired, deafblind specialists, speech and physical therapists, occupational therapists, and many more specialists that supported students from around the world. Paraeducators were invaluable aides in this program, helping students to change clothing and assisting in the teaching, working one-on-one if necessary. Deeply invested in their students' improvement, they wanted to be part of every aspect of the student's day and often lived on campus. Their patience, dedication, and creativity taught me a lot. During the 5 years I taught at Perkins, I also lived on campus in the dorms with the students. I taught physical education, coached, worked in the outreach program, and went on weekend trips with the scouting program. When I first arrived, Perkins had no specific physical education curriculum in the deaf-blind program, though there were several sports teams, cheerleading, wrestling, swimming, and track. These teams competed against other schools for the blind on the East Coast part of the Eastern Athletic Association for the Blind, EAAB. I was surprised that Perkins did not have a team for goalball. In my travels, I had seen and heard much about the sport for the blind, which is played internationally in the Paralympics. Goalball is played in the area the size of a volleyball court. The raised lines that outline the court are thin ropes covered by tape, which enables players to feel the court boundaries easily. At either end are nets, similar to soccer nets, that run the entire length of the goal line. These stop the ball and help with orientation at the back of the court. Three players play against three players, a center and two wings. The basketball-sized ball has bells inside. The object of the game is for one team, the offense, to roll the ball as hard as possible to the other side. The other team, the defense, tries to stop the ball from going over the back goal line by diving with their bodies. Once the defense stops the ball, they become the offense. Teams have only 10 seconds to roll the ball once it's been stopped. Players who may be blind or sighted must wear blindfolds during play. It is a fast and exciting game. When I approached the other physical education teachers, they agreed that Perkins, being a leader in the field, should have a goalball team. We put together a proposal for equipment, salaries for coaches, and fees for travel and tournaments. Though our proposal was ambitious, we did not want to miss the opportunity. If our students learned the sport and played at a competitive level, they could join teams in their hometowns or even try out for national or international competition. With a lot of negotiating, hard work, and convincing, a team was born. The president of Perkins at the time, Kevin Lessard, was supportive and let us recruit our first players at a school-wide assembly. He even came to the goalball assembly and played against the staff and students. This was a hit, of course. I stood on the track above the gym, watching all the kids playing, cheering, and having fun. We recruited key players and were able to put both boys and girls teams together that first year. Then, over winter break, a water leak into the gym buckled the floor. Not a good thing for any gym, but especially dangerous at a school for the blind. The floor had to be replaced. Perkins seized the opportunity and had the new gym floor painted with goalball court lines. From then on, it was known as the Goalball Gym. Today, the Perkins goalball team regularly participates in EAAB tournaments and often finishes in the top three. Sometimes we learn the hard way. At Perkins, I experienced many successes, but I had blunders as well. My very first week, I made a mortifying mistake. After returning to the campus from a long bike ride, I parked my bike near the front entrance of the administration building so I could run inside to get my mail. A secretary suddenly came out screaming, "Whose bike is this? This is a school for the blind. Don't you know anything?" I had left my bike too close to the entrance, blocking the way for anyone who was blind. I felt like an idiot. I should have known better. But my embarrassment was a harsh blessing. It sensitized me even further to experience my environment, as would someone who is visually impaired. Did I forget to push in my chair? Did I leave my bag on the floor? To this day, I move in my environment always aware of the slightest change, gesture, or comment made by a peer that I need to convey to people around me who are blind. Living at Perkins taught me many important lessons, but the hardest and best was an acquired sense of how to move in the world of people who are deafblind. This is a hard lesson even for people in our field. I often go to vision conferences where speakers make gestures, show PowerPoints, or ask the audience to raise their hands without making the visual scene accessible to those who are blind. Early on, I learned to constantly verbalize the visual surroundings, taking the time to explain a picture or relate how many people raise their hands. Eventually, I felt competent and comfortable coaching swimming, goalball, and track and field at Perkins. But when it came time to take the entire swim team to Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia for our first swim meet, I first saw my daily challenges multiplying exponentially. I was about to learn a whole new lesson in teamwork. The train ride from Boston to Philadelphia is 8 hours, and everything takes longer when traveling with a group. I had plenty of time to observe fellow travelers reacting with a combination of pity and awe. They seemed to feel sympathy for the kids, but were also amazed to hear we were heading to a swim meet. "You mean competitive swimming?" someone asked. The athletes, proud of their accomplishments, answered that they were going to compete against other athletes with visual impairments. At first, I was annoyed that people were so ignorant about the potential of children with visual impairments. But soon, I realized that part of my job was educating the general public about the potential of children they viewed as handicapped. I also learned how effective children themselves can be in making this case. This underscored the importance of activities that take children out into the public, precisely so they can educate the community. Not long after the train ride, my ingenuity and patience were tested by a flight to the Maryland School for the Blind for a track meet. A long train ride felt easy compared to navigating airport security in and out of Washington, D.C., where people were bound to be in a hurry. And indeed, we held up the line because we needed to make sure students understood exactly what was going to happen. So the metal detector would not seem like a doorway with no function. I asked security agents to allow the children to pass through with their canes, which contained metal, so that they could hear the detector in action. When I told them a wand would be passed over their bodies, they were confused, so I asked the guards if they could explain the wand and let the students feel it. Most of the guards were accommodating. Of course, education was not their main purpose, but they gave our team a valuable lesson in life skills. Another experience further sensitized me to the anxiety of someone who doesn't quite know what's happening around him. Jordan, who loved to race the tandem tricycle around the gym, was taking his first flight to North Carolina for our goalball tournament. He was a bit anxious, so I explained everything several times before we left and promised him I would sit with him on the plane. As we taxied to the runway, he kept asking, "Are we in the air now? Now? Now?" He held my hand so tightly it hurt. Suddenly, I understood his anxiety. It wasn't just the flying, it was the not knowing. Once we started to speed up, he understood we were gaining momentum to take off. He squeezed my hand even tighter, started to shake, and then smiled. "Now we're taking off?" When we were finally in the air, he relaxed and said, "Well, that wasn't so bad." I learned later that Katie, another athlete sitting just behind us, was as scared as Jordan and hanging on my every word. Such experiences broaden children's comfort zones, encouraging them to try more adventures that move them closer to their potential. But in truth, it had to start with me. Once I stretched my own comfort zone, I was able to translate my experiences into the experiences I wanted to offer my students. In this way, I was playing for the team. And although I already had a graduate degree in adapted physical education, I realized on the job at Perkins that I was just beginning to learn about people with visual or dual sensory impairments. Greg teaches me acceptance. At the time, Greg was the happiest person I had ever met. He was 27 years old, 5'1", with thinning hair and several teeth missing due to his seizures and falls. His seizure disorder was so severe he had to wear a helmet. Sometimes on our walks, he would fall to the ground. I couldn't catch him. He was too tall and heavy. After a few moments, he would recover from the seizure, rest, and then continue. He had a slight limp due to his hemiplegia cerebral palsy and carried a few pounds in his middle. He was totally blind and had an intellectual disability. Yet, none of this stopped him from being involved with recreation on campus. One day, Greg and I decided to join some of the other Perkins teachers, staff, and students on a walkathon to raise money for AIDS. For about 3 weeks, we rode a side-by-side bike around the campus, stopping to ask staff and teachers to contribute. We collected quite a bit of money for the walkathon, but sadness lay ahead. In the early 1990s, AIDS was controversial, and it turned out that Greg's mother didn't want him to participate in the fundraising. She objected to him associating with those kind of people. This was the first time I saw Greg unhappy. We donated what we had raised to the AIDS Foundation, and that made him feel better. But the experience made me think about how the bias towards people with AIDS was not so different from unfair attitudes towards people with visual impairments. Anyone perceived as different faces two barriers: their perceived differences and the public prejudice against them. Tim teaches me respect for individual interests. Tim was 22, blind, and autistic. He was 5'5" and very thin, with short blonde hair. He could create music with his throat by tapping on his chest. He made us laugh by tapping and mouthing, "Chick-chicka, oh yeah." He also loved dialing 800 numbers and was proud one night when he got the scoop on Hurricane Hugo by searching for the early warning 800 number. Tim had a keen sense of hearing. He would often say, "Lauren, what is this I hear?" I would not have heard the car alarm in the distance, for example, or music coming out of someone's room until he pointed it out to me. Once I found the source, he was content. His curiosity about the world around him was astounding, but it wasn't long before I realized there were things he could not completely comprehend because of his blindness. For a while, he was fascinated with roller coasters, though he had never been on one. He researched them diligently and knew the location of each one in New England, including its length, speed, height, and cost. He would discuss roller coasters, essentially unknown entities to him, with anyone who would listen. One day, after a lot of planning during a field trip, he got his chance. Everything was explained to him, from getting aboard the bucket seat and strapping in to waiting for the attendant to let him out at the end of the ride. When we got to the park, he sat down and was strapped in. But just as the ride was about to start, he announced, "I'm done! I want to get off!" Apparently, this experience was enough for Tim to understand roller coasters. He never mentioned them again. His interests ranged from hot air balloons to helicopters to natural gas, objects difficult for those with visual impairments to comprehend. Staff members might have shrugged off his curiosity as perseveration, the medicalized term for repetition of a thought, utterance, or action long after the stimulus that prompted it has ceased. Instead, at Perkins, they treated him with patience and respect. In each case, he was permitted to plan an outing to experience a hot air balloon or a helicopter or natural gas plant. Once Tim had experienced each of these adventures, he did not talk about them again. His curiosity has been satisfied. Watching the staff working with him successfully was a valuable learning experience for me. Tony shows me the importance of seeing past difficult behaviors. 12-year-old Tony presented particular challenges and took all of his classes one-on-one. Although I thought it would be difficult to complete all the physical education units with just the two of us, I was determined to try. Christine, one of Tony's teachers, gave me a warning. Tony often pulled women's hair. She suggested that if Tony did that to me, I should push his fingers down to force him to let go. Sure, it would never happen. I blithely met Tony for our first class in a lonely basement exercise room. The plan was to start with a biking warm-up. Tony was small for his age, so I needed to lower the seat on the exercise bike. As I bent down to lower the seat, he grabbed the barrettes on both sides of my head, yanked hard on huge clumps of hair, and started screaming, "Help! Help!" Shocked, I nevertheless remembered what Christine had told me and pushed down hard on both of his hands. One hand came off, still clutching a barrette with a huge clump of hair in it. I put both my hands on the other hand to try to remove it. He then dropped the barrette from his free hand and put that hand back on my head, pulling at a new clump of hair. He removed his other hand just long enough to drop the second barrette before this hand too returned to my head. I looked at the floor and saw two barrettes and two clumps of hair. With both hands, Tony continued pulling my hair, still screaming, "Help!" at the top of his lungs. This went on for what felt like forever until Christine finally returned. By the time she got him to let go, four clumps of my hair lay on the floor, and I was in tears. Not only was I in pain, but I felt such a humiliating loss of control that I couldn't teach my other classes that day. After the pain and humiliation came the doubt. Was this the right job for me? Was I really fit to teach children with multiple disabilities? After deep reflection and consultation with others, I reached a new level of confidence that what I was doing was meaningful. I came to see it as fortuitous that Tony had put my determination to the test. I learned to work successfully with Tony, always keeping my hair out of harm's way. Casey helps me understand Plan B. Casey, a young woman who was totally deaf and totally blind, loved the pool. She loved it so much that she never wanted to get out, and her determined resistance became dangerous for the staff and other students. Straightforward ways of asking her or compelling her to leave the pool were simply not working. My talented teaching partner, Monica Kleeman, patient and methodical when it came to behavior issues, helped me to figure out an ingenious solution, which she called Plan B. Monica set up a system where Casey would swim laps with pool batons. Casey would get 10 batons for 20 laps in the pool. Each time Casey finished a two-lap cycle, she had to get out of the water to grab the next baton, which was on the table 5 feet from the edge. After she delivered her last baton, we signed that swimming was finished. Because she was already out of the pool, it was easier to transition her to the locker room. Plan B worked. Monica's creativity helped Casey enjoy the pool and do what she loved with an invented way to help her stop when it was time to stop. Brian teaches me that individual expression is part of life. I remember Art Linkletter's old TV show, Kids Say the Darndest Things. They also do the darndest things, often in and around the swimming pool. At age 13, Brian was profoundly deaf, visually impaired, and nonverbal, and he had an intellectual disability. He was also physically strong and strong-willed. One day, a group of visiting teachers from Russia were poolside observing how we instructed our students. That's the day Brian bolted away from the para educator helping him, put on his bathing suit in the locker room, ran out to the pool clapping and singing, and proceeded to sit on the bench with the Russians, stark naked. I was in the pool with other students and couldn't leave them to help Brian put on his suit. Eventually, after much coaxing, we got Brian into the pool wearing his swimsuit. The lesson: there's a lot they don't teach you in graduate school. Robert teaches me openness to change. Robert was deafblind and had Usher syndrome, the symptoms of which are hearing loss and a visual impairment called retinitis pigmentosa. He was born deaf and then slowly began to lose his peripheral and night vision. At 8 years old, Robert was extremely smart, energetic, and often mischievous. Sometimes he tried to change my lesson plan into an experience he found more interesting. For example, once he wanted to turn the gym into a solar system. We ran to Pluto, skipped to Neptune, and scooterboarded to Mars. As long as we could cover my objectives for the class, it worked for both of us. His design your own lesson habit continued in the pool, where he would run to the deep end, dive in, and swim away. This made it harder to cover my objectives. He gleefully evaded my signs by staying under the water for a long time. Treading water in the deep end while signing instructions was difficult, so I had to communicate what I could when he came up for air. Eventually, we reached an agreement that included fun goals along with the more technical ones. One day in the gym, I wanted him to pick up a ball at his feet. He did not respond to my sign and kept looking away. I assumed he was being mischievous again and sternly told him to pay attention. But when I reached down to pick up the ball, he surprised me by telling me he hadn't known it was there. I realized then that his Usher syndrome had progressed and he had lost that field of vision. This was another lesson for the teacher about people with visual impairments. Don't assume that what's in your field of vision is also in theirs, or that their previous field of vision is their current one. See what others see became my mantra, one I would apply in many other circumstances in my life. I ran into Robert years later at Rochester Institute of Technology. He was earning his degree there and being independent in college life. Eddie makes me a believer. You can read all the books you want about how accomplishment depends on will and determination, but until you see it in action over and over, you may not really believe it. Eddie, the deafblind swimmer introduced at the beginning of this chapter, made me a believer. On my first Halloween at Perkins, I wore a clown suit and rode my unicycle across campus. I put plastic spoke beads on the wheel so the kids who could hear could tell where I was. Eddie shared a wonderful memory from before he became deafblind of seeing a clown riding a unicycle in the circus. "When are you going to teach me how to ride?" he asked me. I paused. Unicycles are difficult to master, even for people with perfect hearing and sight. But Eddie persisted for several weeks, and I gave in. To start, we went out to the track, where he could hold a guide wire with one hand and my hand with the other. In cold weather, we moved into the gym, where he used a horizontal ladder spanning the gym wall as a guide. When he got more confident, he would let go of the ladder and ride independently onto the gym floor. One day, he headed all the way across the gym, my heart pounding as he approached the wall. Happily, his ability to see contrasts alerted him when to stop. In the spring, we went outside again. The track's wide white lines that guided children with low vision enabled Eddie to ride halfway around by himself. I had just taught a student who was deafblind to ride a unicycle. What a lesson in determination for both of us. Eddie truly opened my eyes to the fact that there are few limits to what a person who is deafblind can do. This was one of the proudest moments of my teaching career. You can see a video of Eddie riding the unicycle on YouTube if you type in "boy who is deafblind riding unicycle." Boppin shows me deafblindness doesn't hold a student back. Raised in India and fluent in several languages, Boppin was born deaf and later lost his sight to an eye infection from dirt acquired while playing rugby. Had he been in the United States, the infection might have been cleared up with antibiotics, but in his case, it caused total blindness. Boppin could understand sign language through touch and through the movement of a hand on top of his hand, and he could carry on a conversation with one hand while walking. In his physical education class, he chose to run so he could get in shape for races. When we ran on the Charles River bike path, we held hands with fingers entwined in order to stay connected. I had to laugh as people whistled when they drove by in their cars. They thought we were holding hands romantically, not knowing Boppin was deafblind. In addition to participating on Perkins athletic teams, Boppin competed for years in the Special Olympics in track, bowling, and swimming. The people at the Special Olympics assumed that because he was deafblind, he must have an intellectual disability. One day, as he and I were running, I asked him if he had been diagnosed with an intellectual disability, and he got upset. "No, why?" I told him that the Special Olympics were for people with intellectual disabilities. He belonged in the Paralympics, which are for people with physical disabilities. Needless to say, he was furious at the staff at the Special Olympics for the assumption that they made. Nobody had told him about the population he was competing against. Unfortunately, linking blindness or deafblindness with intellectual disability is a common stereotype. After attending college, Boppin went on to teach computer technology to people with deafblindness, eventually working with the government-funded ICANN Connect, the Deafblind Technology Equipment Distribution Program. This is valuable work. Before email and Facebook, deafblindness could be intensely lonely and isolating. Now, thanks to technology and teachers like Boppin, it's easier for people who are deafblind to connect with friends and family at all hours. A well-known advocate for people who are deafblind, Boppin travels the world conducting training sessions and advocating on behalf of the potential of people who are deafblind. I am proud to have been one of his teachers. Jordan teaches me echolocation. I had studied echolocation, the ability of a person who is blind to detect objects ahead by listening to the echo off walls, trees, or cars. It's how bats navigate. However, experiencing echolocation is another matter. Jordan, 12 years old, was blind and a terrific athlete on our goalball team, swim team, and track team. He also loved to ride the side-by-side bikes around the gym. While riding with me one day, he asked me if I trusted him. I said, "Yes, of course I do." He told me to close my eyes, and then he quickly accelerated the bike to 20 to 25 miles per hour. Then suddenly he slammed on the brakes. When I opened my eyes, I saw we were inches from the gym wall. "Did I scare you?" he asked. "Yes, down to my socks." But at that moment, I more fully understood echolocation and how this unique ability contributed to Jordan's talent as an athlete. Jordan was also an articulate spokesperson for Perkins. Although the school is world-renowned, some think it's not inclusive enough, and that all children should live at home and attend their local schools. One day, Jordan and I were introduced to a visiting administrator from another school. It became clear early in our conversation that this administrator was skeptical of Perkins' style of separate education for students who are blind or visually impaired. The administrator asked Jordan why he was at Perkins and not at his local school. In the year that I had known him, Jordan had never uttered an unkind word, misbehaved, or became angry. He faced the administrator, grew very quiet, and took a deep breath before responding. "When I was in my hometown school, they did not know what to do with me. I was left out and neglected. When they did not want me to do something because they didn't know how to teach me or keep me safe, I became frustrated. I did not know what to do and felt isolated and desperate. I threw chairs, pushed people, and could not control my anger. Being here is 100% better for me. I will never go back there." That was the end of their conversation, but the beginning of my deeper awareness of children's ability to be vigorous advocates for their own opportunities to learn, perform, and excel. Years later, I saw Jordan at a conference and yelled out to him, "Jordan!" I was so excited that I forgot to say my name, as is customary when meeting someone who's blind. But he immediately remembered my voice and called back, "Coach Lauren!" We hugged, and then he caught up with me on his life, his marriage, and the rewarding consulting position that had brought him to the conference. Jordan is a prime example of a young person reaching their full potential. He carries on his involvement in sports and continues to use his own brand of echolocation to inspire deeper awareness and advocacy in others, just as he did for me. New opportunities. While teaching at Perkins, I was asked to speak at several conferences across the country. I shared the adaptations I had made for children who were sensory impaired and had multiple disabilities, and I learned the techniques of others. As I began to compile a binder of modified games and activities, I had an idea to turn it into a book. I had already met the perfect partner for this endeavor, Jim Cowart, a physical education teacher at the California School for the Blind. Jim, well known in the fields of blindness and adapted physical education, had been teaching for over 20 years and was close to retirement. He was tall, muscular, and built like a bicyclist, which he was. He wore little reading glasses and he loved to tinker in his garage, making modified equipment, such as beepers telling golfers who are visually impaired where the holes are. Luckily, we found teachers from other schools for the blind who, like us, loved to adapt activities in a typical PE curriculum, such as basketball, soccer, volleyball, and tennis. I mailed out templates, as this was before widespread use of computers. Some teachers even handwrote their games onto my template for me to type up. Jim and I sent the games back and forth between California and Massachusetts until we produced a unified set of activities, including one for the pool. Near the end of my time at Perkins, we signed a book contract with Human Kinetics, HK, in Champaign, Illinois. We named the book Games for People with Sensory Impairments. This was the first of many books I would publish with Human Kinetics. Jim was the perfect co-author for my first book. Perkins opened several more wonderful opportunities for me, including doctoral classes at Boston College and participation in the college's educational leadership program, which was hosted by Perkins. People who worked with children with visual impairments and deaf blindness came from all over the world to join these programs. Most significantly, Perkins also paid for my classes at Oregon State University, the mecca for adapted physical education, in Corvallis over two summers. While studying in Oregon, the second summer I faced a hard choice. I was fortunate enough to be offered a graduate assistantship in the Movement Studies and Disabilities program. A government leadership grant would pay for my classes and provide me with a sizable stipend, but only for the next 3 years. In order to accept the grant, I would need to start attending full-time that next year. I had always known I would go back to school for a PhD. My mother, who had her doctorate, was a fanatic about education. She would always say, "So, when you get your PhD," all my life, I had known it was not if, but when. Still, I had been at Perkins for only 5 years and wasn't ready to leave. Unfortunately, many decisions come down to money. Without the federal grant, I couldn't earn my degree for free. I thus made the difficult decision to leave Perkins to pursue my PhD.